You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 272, Exodus 12, part 2A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing this week?
Well, pretty good. Busy. We're starting to, think about boxing stuff up. Yes, I know it's going to be months and months till we actually move, but it's going to be just a few weeks before I have to find room for the library that I keep at work.
Yeah.
It's like we're already chucking stuff, like making room for that. So
when is the actual date of moving?
Oh, we'll move. The plan is to move right after Christmas, so maybe the first week of January, something like that.
Okay.
Or a few days later after Christmas. I mean, we're not going to be putting out a big spread for Christmas. The kids just want to try to have Christmas at the house. So.
Yeah, and what about the kids that are there in Washington? Are they sad that you're leaving? Are they going to stay? Are they coming? Or.
Oh no, everybody's coming along. The only one that's sort of hemming and hawing is Calvin. So Calvin's caught between this, I want to get out of the house and get a roommate and be on my own, or as opposed to, doing that in Florida. So we'll see. It's up to him. But my oldest, who lived in Seattle, her and her husband have moved. They've been back in our little town here for probably a year. But they're going to move with us too. So everybody's going. The only question is Calvin. And my other daughter's already in North Carolina on the East Coast. So, everybody's in moving mode.
A big exodus.
Even though it's a long way away.
Yeah, that's a big exodus from Washington State. No pun intended.
Oh, that was clever, Trey. I saw what you did there.
Yeah.
Right. We're not leaving any bondage, though. We didn't. Oh. It's not precipitated by any plagues or anything like
that. Well, at least we don't have to argue about the date like we have been and are going to do.
That's right. Yeah, 100 years from now, when did Heiser actually move? Was it December or January?
Right, 2020, 2019. 1,000 years from now, yep, it'll be here. Yep. People are doing podcasts about Mike Heiser's exodus from Washington State.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That'll be a big item of concern, I'm sure.
We also want to mention, though, I'm curious. I want to know where people come down on the date issue. So we ask people to have a conversation and hashtag it with Naked Bible. I want to see, what the people are saying out there. So after this podcast and after the last podcast, if you have an opinion, hashtag it Naked Bible and let us know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a bad idea. We're going to spend the whole episode on the date of the Exodus. Before we jump in there, I really. This is kind of funny, but I thought I should mention, there was somebody that reviewed Unseen Realm yesterday. I happened to look at the Amazon page and clicked through the reviews. And so there's this guy, he gave the book a really good, five-star review, but then he put in it, I was a little concerned about him citing Ellen White. That's my only reservation. And it made me laugh because he's thinking the Ellen White of the, 19th century, early 20th. I can't remember when she lived, but the Ellen White of the Seventh-day Adventist founding, this is not the same Ellen White. if you look in the footnotes at the book by her that I cite, she's a recent PhD student, actually, of Mark Smith. I reviewed her book and interact with a little bit in Unseen Realm, but it made me laugh. But I thought, maybe I should say something, on the podcast for people who read footnotes. No, it's not that Ellen White. So, if you get a chuckle out of that, good, because I did.
Well, at least he didn't.
But anyway, we're going to
a star for that. At least he gave you full.
Right, stars, right. So I've been knocked stars for some really head scratching reasons. Too much information, 2 stars. Okay, I guess I deserve that then. But that happens. So yeah, I mean, that all kidding aside, now we are going to spend the episode on the date of the Exodus as I telegraphed last time. And so what I decided to do on the web page for this episode, there are going to be links to several articles, the two main ones. I'm going to mention here in a moment. But I figured what I would do for this is interact with a, you know, fairly recent. I mean, it's, I don't know, 10, 15 years old. These are, yeah, 10 years old or so. Some recent treatments of the date of the Exodus that appeared in theological journals. And you know, it's nice that back in 2007, the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society had both sides, you know, had scholars, you know, who take different views. They both wrote essays, and they're responsive to each other as well on this topic. So what I'm going to do is interact with both of these, and I'll bring a few other things in, you know, where it matters. But all of these articles are going to be accessible to listeners if you want to go up and read them for yourself. I'm going to basically go through five sort of items, points that get discussed in these articles, and you'll be able to see who takes what side and how they respond to the other side, and you know what the arguments mean, how they're presented, how they defend their respective views. So for listeners who, you know, maybe didn't catch the earlier episodes when we talked about chronology, or are just not sort of, you know, up on this topic at all, maybe they've never looked at it, you know, the date of the Exodus, well, what's that about? There are two main dates. I mean, there are more than two views of this, but the two major positions are what has become known as the early date, that is 1446 BC. And a guy like Bryant Wood, who has his PhD from the University of Toronto in Syro-Palestinian archaeology. Bryant is an evangelical. I happen to know him. He is an early dater. He would be representative, and so I will be referencing him and his article, which is entitled "The Biblical Date for the Exodus is 1446 BC, a response to James Hoffmeyer." That is in the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, again, back in 2007. Link to that on the episode page. So naturally, the other side is going to be Jim Hoffmeyer. He's going to hold the late date, which typically, you know, you'll see that sort of pegged at sometime between 1270 and 1260 BC. So not quite 200 years later than the early date. Jim Hoffmeyer teaches at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He also has his PhD from the same institution as Bryant Wood, the University of Toronto. But Hoffmeyer's degree is in Egyptology. So his article is entitled, "What is the Biblical Date of the Exodus? A Response to Bryant Wood." Okay, so they go back and forth in the same issue of the journal. And that's how I'm going to proceed through this topic. I'm going to take five items of argumentation that both sides will interact with. And then at the end, you know, listeners can draw their own conclusions about which arguments were better, or you know, however they want to look at it. And I'll mix in a few of my own gut responses, you know, to arguments and attempted rebuttals of those arguments as we go on. There are points where I think the rebuttals on both sides are kind of weak or not, can certainly be, I would put the label uncertain on them, which means, you know, if we were keeping score, the side that they were trying to rebut would get a point on my scorecard. But I'm not going to keep points to the episode. You can keep points if you want. We're just going to go through the material. So the first, you know, item for discussion would be these two verses, you know, considered in tandem, 1 Kings 6:1 and Exodus 12:40. So this is item number one, these two verses. Now, the Wood article, obviously, he's going to take 1 Kings 6:1 as kind of a basic starting point. That's the verse. I'm just going to read it to listeners. It says this: "In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began," that is Solomon, "to build the house of the Lord." So this places the, basically, if you take this at face value, it says, in the fourth year of Solomon, when he began to build the temple, that was 480 years removed from the Exodus. So it's just a simple mathematical thing. Now, the date of Solomon's accession to the throne is really not disputed. Again, I've made the comment before. When you get down past 1000 BC, especially when the Bible starts to interact with Assyrian kings, The Assyrian chronology is a lot more secure than Egyptian chronology. It's astronomically based, you know, with sure techniques, you know, very well understandable, correlatable techniques with modern astronomical tools. So it's just a matter of finding, you know, linchpins with Assyrian rulers and biblical figures, and then you can start to build a chronology for the Bible. And so Solomon's reign, the dates of it, are really not controversial at all. Just about everybody's going to agree, you know, within a, you know, plus or minus a year, that Solomon came to the throne in roughly 970 BC. That would make his fourth year 966 BC, because we're going in the lesser direction, because this is BC dating. So 966, go back 480 years, and you have 1446 BC. That would be your date of the Exodus. So that's a really simple, you know, thing. Now, we've talked about that number before. We also talked about Exodus 1240 in the last episode. The time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. So what Wood says in his article, this is sort of where he starts, and he writes as follows. And he's specifically commenting at this point on Exodus 1240. Although the Septuagint data differ from the Masoretic text at some points, and again, we talked about that in the last episode, the Septuagint certainly does not support a 13th century Exodus date. Okay, let me just stop there. So Wood's saying, look, I know all about Exodus 1240. If you recall the end of the last episode, I had a quote from Hofmeyer there, where Hofmeyer says, look, if we take the 430 from the Septuagint, and we should, because Paul uses the Septuagint when he talks about Moses and Sinai, he has the same number, 430, even though, again, recall that Paul loops Abraham in there, and Exodus 1240 in the Septuagint doesn't actually do that by name. But anyway, Hofmeyer would say, look, if you're going to take the Septuagint seriously, and you've got that number with 430, and it includes, you know, some of the patriarchal era, you know, in that number with the, you know, the date of the bondage and all, or the duration of the bondage and all that, Hofmeyer said, you know, lots of people have noticed that 430 is neatly divisible into 215 and 215. So Hofmeyer and others would argue that the sojourn in Egypt, the period of affliction, is 215 years. And then the 215 years prior to that, you know, you got the two sides of your equation there, you know. So that's how they would do chronology. And Wood is saying, look, I know all about that, but just because we have this number, this 430 number, that doesn't actually tell us where to put that number in terms of what century the Exodus occurs. And he's right there. It doesn't really tell you where to put it. You know, Hofmeyer says if you take the 215 and the 215, again, the way he and many other scholars want you to take it, you wind up with Joseph being back in the Hyksos period. Again, if the first half of the 215, the second half, if the dividing line between those two, you know, is the before affliction, after affliction, if that's the way we should look at that, then, you know, Hofmeyer says, you know, there's no other conclusion to draw. Joseph was in the Hyksos period, and that's going to work with other arguments that he has. And Wood is saying, well, the verse doesn't actually say any of that. It doesn't tell us how to use the 430. And then Wood goes on and he says, now, there's too much assumed from the math anyway. And so he references an article by Ray, which I also have linked on the episode page. And, you know, Ray basically, you know, has a number of arguments about this number 430 and what can and cannot be said from it. So the general way to summarize this is Ray agrees, look, we're making too much of the math. Who cares if it's neatly divided into two halves and 215? You know, why do we assume that 430 is 430 to give us a 250-year, you know, pre-affliction and affliction? Why do we make these assumptions? So Ray presents a panoply of arguments about, you know, why this is not a necessary conclusion for the number 430. But I'll simplify to what I think to be the most significant problem that Ray notes, or at least the objection. He writes this. He says, it will be pertinent to begin our analysis with the two Old Testament passages that are the most relevant to our discussion. Exodus 1240, because remember Ray's article is about the number 430 in this passage. And Genesis 15, 13 through 21. Again, that should be familiar from the previous episode of the podcast. Ray writes, the former is given within a chronological statement in the context of the account of the Exodus itself. The latter, that is Genesis 15, is in the setting of God's ratification of his covenant with Abraham, because that's what Genesis 15 is about. Now, again, Genesis 15 included both the confirming of the promises of the seed, Ray points out, that's verses 13 and 17, or through 17, and then the land grant, verses 18 through 21. So he's saying, look, there's a context for these two passages, and Genesis 15 actually gives us the number of 400, whereas Exodus 12:40 gives us 430. But the context for both are different. And again, I should remind you of what the Septuagint actually says here at this point, because Ray is going to do something with this. So if you're reading the Septuagint, at least, you know, one edition of the Septuagint, you would read this at Exodus 12:40. Now, the sojourn of the children of Israel during which they dwelt in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan was 430 years. Now, Ray points out that even if we accept the 430 years with the Septuagint in that verse, and even if we accept the Septuagint's inclusion of you know, to sort of loop Abraham in there, even if we sort of assume that, and then we seek to define the sojourn as part of this, as an equal half, you know, 215. Even if we do that, like all the late daters want us to do that, we still have a contradiction with Genesis 15, 13 through 16. Genesis 15, 13 is very plain. I'm going to read it to you. Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. So we have a problem. If we take Exodus 12:40 and we explain the 430 as including the patriarchs, we go with the Septuagint. If we, with Hoffmeyer, would argue, you know, along with Ray, if we say that that 430 is to be split in half and gives us a 215-year duration of the affliction, which puts Joseph in the Hyksos period rather nicely for the late date, and works out, you know, with Ramses on the other side as being the pharaoh of the Exodus. Even if we let him do all that, there's still a question that remains. You have a 215-year affliction now, but Genesis 15, 13 says point blank, it was 400 years. So you're barely over half for an affliction of what this other verse outside of Exodus 12:40 says. It's a plain contradiction. So again, Genesis 15, 13, basically they would argue, Wood and Ray would argue, that it defies the math imposed on the 430 years of Exodus 12:40. And the only way to avoid this obvious contradiction is to take the 430 and not divide it into, you know, 215, 215, but to divide it another way. So here's how you would do it. You know, the way to avoid this is to take the 430, then have the reference to dwelling in the land of Canaan in the Septuagint of Exodus 12:40 as having to do just with Jacob. His time in Canaan, you know, like the good years in Egypt, you know, so Jacob's time in Canaan plus the good times in Egypt while Joseph was alive, and then followed by a period of affliction. Now, Jacob lived in Egypt for 17 years. We know that because of Genesis 47:28. It says that, which would then leave 413, so 430 minus 17, 413 for the affliction. And so the 400 of Genesis 15 could be viewed as a rounded off number. I mean, that's workable. But that's a problem for Paul's apparent use of Exodus 12:40, since he loops Abraham into the picture in Galatians 3, 16 and 17. We spent a lot of time talking about this in the last episode. He says the law came 430 years after the promises were made to, not to Jacob, but to Abraham. So Paul links the 430 with Abraham. Very plain language there in Galatians. There's just no way to divide the 430 into two halves of 215 and have Abraham be in the picture, which is what Paul does. And this must mean for Ray and for Wood and the early date that Paul is not reading the 430 years the way that the late daters do. So this is, again, this is, you know, part of Wood's argument. He's saying, look, I know all about the Exodus 12:40 thing, but it doesn't help you. It actually creates problems for the late date, you know, with other verses. It creates problems with Genesis 15. So after referring to Ray to criticize the math of Exodus 12, 40, Wood writes this. The key chronological data for determining the date of the Exodus are 1 Kings 6:1, Judges 11:26, which we'll get to, and 1 Chronicles 6:33 through 37. Judges 11:26 and 1 Chronicles 6:33 through 37 are the same in both the Masoretic text and the Septuagint, while, as Hofmeyer points out, 1 Kings 6:1 is 440 years in the Septuagint rather than the 480 years of the Masoretic text. If one chooses to utilize the Septuagint reading of 1 Kings 6:1, the Exodus still falls in the 15th century, not the 13th century. So Wood's saying, look, I'll concede you the use of the Septuagint in Exodus 12:40, but I'm going to insist that you don't impose math on it. Okay, and you still have to deal with Paul's inclusion of Abraham. And I'll even let you have the Septuagint in 1 Kings 6:1, because if you take off another 40 years, then you still have the Exodus in 1406 BC, not 1446. So he's like, but you know, this can work for me. If I can take the Septuagint just like you want me to, Jim, and I can still come out with a late date because I'm not going to impose artificial math on Exodus 12:40. Because if I do that, it creates contradictions with Genesis 15. So what Wood is trying to do here is neutralize or eviscerate the Septuagint appeal to Exodus 12:40 that the late daters will invariably use to defend their system. And of course, Hofmeyer is one of these. So this is how he does it. And for Wood, 1 Kings 6:1 ultimately is a benchmark date to be taken at face value, whether you use the Masoretic text or the Septuagint. It's either 480 or 440, and the numbers mean what they say. See, now for Hofmeyer on the other side, you know, if you've scrunched, you know, the affliction down to 215, you know, that's going to affect the way you look at 1 Kings 6:1 and your whole system. You know, the 215 putting Joseph in the Hyksos period, having, you know, as we're going to see, having the Ramses of Exodus 1:11 be Ramses II. There's no way that you can get 480 years, literal years, between the fourth year of Solomon and the time of Ramses II. So, you know, Hofmeyer's going to have to do, and all late daters have to not take 1 Kings 6:1 at face value. The 480 doesn't mean 480. It's symbolic of something. And Wood, of course, knows this. But he's saying, look, I can take the Septuagint. Doesn't matter. We need to take the numbers at face value here in both these verses. The math you impose on Exodus 12:40 creates problems for you, and Wood is ultimately going to object to making 480 symbolic. He continues, Hofmeyer, when he's forced to deal with the 480 of 1 Kings 6:1, he'll say, look, it's very obvious that 480 is divisible. It's 12 times 40. And 40 is typically the number for a generation. You know, when one, you know, a son gets married and starts having children, you know, 40, that's like a generation. And there's 12. That would be, you know, it's a symbolic number, 12 generations of 40, 12 tribes of Israel, you know. So he's like, there's obvious symbolism here. So Hofmeyer, again, views the 480 years as symbolic. And since he doesn't need to take it literally, and he does need to have Joseph in the Hyksos period, and he does need and wants, you know, Ramses II to be the Pharaoh of the Exodus, he's actually pretty precise. He'll actually date the Exodus to precisely 1267 BC. Hofmeyer believes that the Hebrew slaves were used in the construction of the new capital of Ramses II, Ramses II's, you know, capital. And so since he connects those two things, he can be pretty precise, you know, as far as the dating. So that's his date, 1267. Now, again, Wood knows all of this. This is sort of the basic beginning point for the entire discussion. What do we do with 1 Kings 6:1? Does 480 mean 480? How can it not, you know, how can it mean 480 if you want to take a late date like this? Because 1 Kings 6:1 mentions the fourth year of Solomon. Everybody knows when that was. It was 966. You do the math. There's no way you wind up at 1267. You wind up at 1446 BC. So everybody knows that the late daters are going to take 480 as a symbolic number. They're going to use Exodus 12:40, especially with the Septuagint, to work out, you know, or to align, you know, with that scenario. And Wood saying, look, I'm not opposed to the Septuagint. I'm opposed to your math. And there's just no way that this is going to, you know, to work if we take the number at face value. But I know you don't take the number at face value, and I just think that's the wrong method. So what Wood tries to do to argue that this is the wrong way to look at the numbers, you know, he does a few things. Let me just read a little bit from him. So Wood, again, is writing of Hoffmeyer's position, of the late date position. He says, it's not feasible to fit the events of an Exodus 1, 11 to 12, 36 in a 3-year time span. Now, let me stop there. Wood says, okay, not only do I object with the way you symbolize 480, but if you want to pinpoint the Exodus to 1267 BC, like 3 years after Ramses II gets to the throne, and this is what Exodus 1 is about. It's about this building program of Ramses, and he uses the Israelites in there. If you want to argue that, then what you're forced to do is you have to read the entirety of Exodus 1 all the way through Exodus 12, all the way up to the Passover. You have to read all that as happening in 3 years. And late daters do. They do have to do that. So Wood says, it's just not feasible to fit the events of Exodus 1:11 to chapter 12, verse 36, in a 3-year time span. Following the building of Pithom and Ramses, the Israelites experienced a growth in population. Quote, Wood quotes Exodus 1:12. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, which had to have taken place over a considerable period of time. This was followed by an escalation of the oppression, Exodus 1:13 and 14. Next, the king decreed that the male Hebrew babies should be put to death, Exodus 1:15 through 19. When the midwives ignored the order, the quote, the people increased and became even more numerous. That's Exodus 1:20, again indicating a long passage of time. So Wood's like, how in the world can all that happen in 3 years? And honestly, you know, it does seem hard to believe, for me anyway, that one could place these items in a 3-year span, as Hoffmeyer's view of the late date requires. And Wood asserts that, you know, and this would be obvious, that the early date doesn't give you any of these problems. It gives you plenty of time. Now, of the symbolic view of 480, Wood writes this. The second major premise of the 13th century model, again, the late date, is that the 480 years of 1 Kings 6:1 is in reality, quote, a symbolic number that derives from 12 times 40, 40 years being a symbolic number for a generation, unquote. Hoffmeyer does not comment on the fact that 1 Chronicles 6, 33 through 37, indicates that there were 19 generations from the time of Moses to the time of Solomon, not 12. Hoffmeyer's treatment of the 40 years as a generation, again, is even more problematic, as he himself demonstrated by his partial list of the occurrences of 40 years in the Hebrew Bible, which Wood provides in full. The use of the number is always associated with an elapsed period of time in the history of Israel and never as a generation. Now, what Wood means here is that the number 40 is used of reigns and other occasions in Israel's history, you know, to represent a specific period of time. It's never clearly, he would say, symbolic for a generation. Now, Wood gives a complete list of the occurrences of the number 40 in an earlier article against the late date. And there's also a link to this one on the episode page. It's called The Rise and Fall of the 13th Century Exodus Conquest Theory. Now, the comeback to this, you know, Hoffmeyer would say, and I think this is an obvious comeback, he would say, come on, doesn't it strike you as odd that so many things happen in 40s? The writer may not have to explain to the reader that 40 isn't about a precise counting of years, but the elapse of a generation. Okay, yeah, there's literally 19 generations between Moses and Solomon. Good. Good for 1 Chronicles. Okay, good. But that isn't what, you know, Hoffmeyer is arguing. He's not arguing against that. He's not saying the number 19 is wrong there. He's saying this number in 1 Kings 6:1, 480 is symbolic because 40s happen everywhere. And it's just so odd. If that represents like an actual time period, it's just kind of incredible that everything happens in units of 40. So to Hoffmeyer, the fact that so many things happen in units of 40, and I'm going to read you the list, it just seems like 40 must mean something different. There must be a reason why the writers keep using 40, because it just feels artificial that everything would be literally happening in units of time of 40 years. Like it's just so odd because there's so many of them. And, you know, Hofmeyr would reference things like in Matthew, Jesus' genealogy. Everybody knows this is an artificial genealogy in terms of its structure, 14, 14, 14. I mean, everybody knows this. Nobody argues about this. So Hofmeyr is saying, look, you know, sometimes when it's not that these people are not historical. It's just that the way that the time of these generations, their span, it gets talked about in an intentionally symbolic way. And since 40 is just so ubiquitous, it just seems like that's the right way to take it. So again, that's in a nutshell what Hofmeyr would come back with. He'd say, look, the writer knew this. The readers would have known this. They know that it's not about, you know, a specific chronology. There's something else going on here. There's some, you know, symbolic, you know, meaning to this. Now the following is from Wood's list. You know, Wood is the writer between the two that gives you the grocery list of all the things that happened in 40. So here's this little, he has it in a footnote in that one article I just mentioned. So here are the things, you know, that he lists. And just ask yourself, do all these things happening in 40s give the impression of literal coincidence or artificial sort of symbolic use? I mean, that's the question, Dan. That's the question a late dater would pose, you know, to you. So here's Wood's footnote. During the flood, it rained for 40 days and nights. I'm going to leave the verse references out just to get through it. During the flood, it rained for 40 days and nights. 40 days after the ark landed, Noah sent out a raven. Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, as was Esau when he married Judith. The embalming of Jacob took 40 days. The spies spent 40 days in Canaan. Joshua was 40 when he went with the spies to Canaan. Israel spent 40 years in the wilderness. Moses was on Mount Sinai 40 days and nights, the first time he received the law, as he was the second time. Moses fasted 40 days and nights for the sin of the golden calf. There were 40 years of peace during the judgeships of Othniel, Deborah, and Gideon. The Israelites were oppressed by the Philistines 40 years. Eli judged Israel 40 years. Ishbosheth was 40 when he took the throne following Saul's death. David reigned for 40 years, as did Solomon. Elijah traveled 40 days and nights from the desert of Beersheba to Mount Horeb. Ezekiel lay on his right side for 40 days for the 40 years of the sins of Judah. Ezekiel predicted that Egypt would be uninhabited for 40 years. And Jonah preached that Nineveh would be overturned in 40 days. Okay, that's the end of Wood's footnote. Now, there's a lot of stuff happening in 40s. Again, the question is, and Hofmeyr would say, look, it just strikes me as too coincidental to believe that all of these uses of 40s are supposed to be understood as literal, you know, progression of time, 40 years, 40 days, whatever it is. And we haven't even, you know, gotten into the multiples of 40, like, you know, the 480 is for 1 Kings 6:1. So Hofmeyr says, look, there's a lot of other things that really indicate that the Exodus occurred during the time of Ramses II. And if that is the case, then not only does it seem like we should take 1 Kings 6:1, the 480 there, as symbolic, but we really have to. And that brings us to the second content item, Exodus 1:11 and Ramses. So if for early daters, the 480 of 1 Kings 6:1 is like kind of, you know, a linchpin argument. If that's the case, and it is, you know, for that view. And because again, they'll argue that if you don't look at it that way, you've got these other chronological problems that develop. Since that is the linchpin argument for them, this is the linchpin argument for the late date. And so here we go. Exodus 1:11 and Ramses. Now we've had a whole episode on this before, and you know, but basically the scholarly infighting that goes on over this. Wood obviously rejects the idea that the Ramses, you know, Ramses in Exodus 1:11 is Ramses II. Wood rejects that. Wood views Ramses or Ramses in the verse as a place name updating. If you remember that from the earlier episode, it says, you know, Ramses there because a later editor put it there. It changed an older name that the place would have been named, you know, during the early date of the Exodus before Ramses, was born, before we had a Ramesside dynasty. It was called something else, Avaris, Tanis Avaris, that whole area. And so later on, an editor changed the name to Ramses so that his readers would know what in the world, what geographical place we were even talking about. Because it did change, again, in real time. And so the Bible had to be editorial updated in terms of this place name. So that's Wood's view. Now, Hoffmeyer raises some objections to this, again, because this is a real linchpin issue for the late date. And I'm gonna go through a couple of these. He says, first, in places in the Hebrew Bible where a place name is updated, there is consistently formulaic language of explanation by the biblical writer. I'm going to read you a few of these and see if you can detect a pattern to your ear. Genesis 14:12. These kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinav, king of Adma, Shem-Ever, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is, Zoar. So Bela, the place, he's saying, in other words, Zoar. Genesis 14:3. And all these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is, the Salt Sea. So again, it's an editorial about the place. Genesis 14:7. They turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is, Kadesh. En Mishpat, that is, in other words, Kadesh. Okay. Genesis 23:2. Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is, Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Genesis 28:19. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the place was Luz at the first. So of the five instances, and I just read you the five, Hoffmeyer says, of the five instances in which the Old Testament has, I didn't read you these five, happened 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, this is a different five Hoffmeyer is referring to here, so I don't want to create confusion. He says, of the five instances in which the Old Testament has the name Ramses as a toponym is a place name, he says, none of those instances has any of this formulaic explanatory language. So here's his argument. He's like, look, Bryant, I know that biblical writers do update place names. I get it. But when they do that, there will be the language of explanation when they do it. So-and-so, that is, this place. They called the place this, but unto this day, it's that. I mean, there's some sort of explanatory formulaic language, usually that is, or in other words, going on. Every time Ramses as a name occurs in the Old Testament, none of that happens. And so consequently, Hoffmeyer argues that this is not an editorial updating. He argues that the name Ramses, again in the Hebrew, Ra'amses, is not an updating. It is one of the pharaohs named Ramses. And Hoffmeyer, argues on the basis of where they're at in the Delta and the slavery and all that kind of stuff. He argues that it's Ramses II. So that's his first challenge, to Wood. Where's the formulaic language? Where does the biblical writer explain this as an updating? Oh, they don't. So why are you calling it an updating? Oh, I know why you're calling it an updating. Because you need to. You can't have the Pharaoh of the Exodus be Ramses II because you're taking the 480 in 1 Kings 6:1 at face value. There's no way you can live with the Pharaoh or with the name Ramses in Exodus 1:11 actually be Ramses II. You have to get rid of that. Second, Hoffmeyer charges that the editorial updating argument fails for inconsistency in another respect. Here's what he writes in his article. He says, quote, if the text was changed from an earlier name, such as Avaris, to Ramses, then why was the name not subsequently updated to Zoan, Tanis, the Deltic capital that replaced Ramses around 1070 BC and prospered into Roman times? Now, let me stop there. He's saying, look, if you're arguing that a later editor took the name Avaris, got rid of it, put in Ramses, well, guess what, Bryant? Ramses didn't stay the name of that place. It changed again 200 years later. So why didn't the biblical writers after 1070 BC, like during the time of David somewhere, you know, or the monarchy. Why didn't they change it again? Back to Hofmeyr. He says, Zoan or Tanis and not Ramses is used by Asaph in Psalm 78 when he describes the miraculous deeds that resulted in the Exodus. Now, I'm going to read that again because that's really important. He says, look, we know that some editor did do that. They did note the second change to the place name Zoan from Ramses to Zoan because it shows up in the Bible. So why didn't, if there's an editor fiddling around with Exodus 1:11, why didn't that editor also put Zoan in Exodus 1:11? If he didn't want readers to be confused that this wasn't the Pharaoh Ramses, that it wasn't named after that Pharaoh at that time of the Pharaoh. Because elsewhere in the Old Testament, they do put Zoan in there. They do update it. And here, you know, he mentions Psalm 78, and here's the, it's verse 12. Here's the quote of the verse. In the sight of their fathers, he, God, wrought marvels in the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan. Again, writes Hofmeyr, in Psalm 78:43, the fields of Zoan is mentioned, followed by a reference to six of the 10 plagues, Psalm 78:44-51. So plainly, during the first half of the first millennium BC, when Psalm 78 was composed, and P. Ram Esses, you know the city stores, you know, of Ramses there from Exodus 1:11, that place, when that place, P. Ramses, had ceased to exist some centuries earlier, Asaph, the biblical writer, used Zoan because it was the Delta capital. If the five references to Ramses represent an updated toponym, one would expect to find Zoan or Tanis in those places, because that was occupied for more than a millennium, not the short-lived Ramses name. Now, Wood responds this way, and I'm going to be honest with you. I think this response is weak. I think Hofmeyr's point is really interesting, and you know, it's a good comeback. It's a good comeback to the editorial updating position, but Wood responds this way. Again, you might think this is good, but this just feels like it falls short a little bit. Wood says, Hofmeyr questions why the biblical text was not updated with the name Zoan or Tanis, the capital of the Delta from circa 1070 BC to the Roman period. The short answer is that Zoan at Tanis was not located at the site where the Israelites lived, but 19 kilometers to the north-northeast. Comparing the name Ramses in Exodus and Numbers with Zoan in Psalm 78 is mixing apples and oranges. The references in Exodus 1:11, 12:37, Numbers 33:3, and Numbers 33:5 are contemporary references specific to the place where the Israelites lived, later called Ramses. Psalm 78, on the other hand, is a retrospective view that transpired in the vicinity of, but not at, the location where the Israelites once lived. So that's the end of Wood's quote. So Wood links his rebuttal entirely to place where they lived and where they didn't live, like a, you know, just a nearby area. To me, that feels weak because the references in Psalm 78 to the plagues that use the term Zoan, well, can we really be that specific with the plagues? It doesn't feel strong to me. I mean, if I were Wood here, I would hope I could come up with something, you know, better than this, but be that as it may, I mean, I'm not saying Wood's wrong. I mean, he could be right. It just doesn't feel as strong as I'd like it to be. So what you have here is you really can't overstate the importance of Exodus 1:11, not only for the late date, but for the whole question. You know, if Ramses in Exodus 1:11 and these other, you know, these four other passages refers to Ramses II, then there is no debate. The late date is obvious. So that is the linchpin for the late date position, just like the 480 is, you know, for the early date. And again, the chronological problems alternatives might create. That's the linch date for the early date. This is the linchpin, you know, issue for the late date.
All right. Well, we're going to stop it right there, folks. It is as good a place as any to stop it. We're going to wrap up chapter 12. next week, the early date, late date debate. We hope you're enjoying it. So we would love to know what your opinion is on the subject matter. So please use the hashtag NakedBible on social media. And we would love to hear your opinions and thoughts about the early date, late date debate. And also after that, we will be doing a Q&A and then getting back into Exodus with chapter 13. And we also would love for you to take time to leave us a review and rate us on iTunes or wherever you consume us, that people discover us. We'd greatly appreciate it. And with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.